This is the time and place set for argument in Branch Banking versus Girard, case number 73848. Are counsel ready to proceed?
We are.
Please let the clerk know how much time you wish to reserve for rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes.
That's very well.
Your Honors, may it please the Court, I'm Chris Albright here on behalf of the appellant, Branch Banking and Trust Company. I may refer to them from time to time as BBT to avoid getting tongue-tied. I have with me Mark Albright, also counsel for the appellant. And I believe I have representatives from BBT here in the audience. I'd like to echo what was stated at the beginning of the last hearing. Opposing counsel and I have got along very well in this case. We respect each other a great deal. And in that regard, you know, there was a couple of erratas filed earlier this week. And I just wanted to say if, in my haste to get my errata on file, if I worded anything inartfully or in a manner that was accusatory, that was not my intent. I have great respect for opposing counsel and their client and their integrity. Moving on to the case at hand, as you know, we are here to have your de novo review of a dismissal on statute of limitations grounds of a litigation malpractice lawsuit. And I have one sort of major premise that I will return to, I think, again and again in this hearing. And that major premise is from the Semenza case. And in Semenza, this court did two things. First, it articulated a fundamental rule about claim accrual, and then it applied that rule to the particular facts in Semenza. And it's my contention that the fundamental rule is the most important part of that case, and the application that was in that case was one illustration of one possible application. But the fundamental rule is that a claim for litigation malpractice accrues when damages are certain. And we know that because in Semenza, this court listed out the elements of a malpractice claim, including proximately caused damages. And then this court said such an action, quote, does not accrue until the plaintiff knows or should know all facts relevant to the foregoing elements and damage has been sustained. Where damage has not been sustained, or where it is too early to know whether damage has been sustained, a legal malpractice action is premature and should be dismissed. No one has a claim against another without having incurred damages. And then they made the statement that from the above it follows that a legal malpractice action does not accrue until the plaintiff's damages are certain and not contingent upon the outcome of an appeal. And I would argue today that from the fundamental rule it also follows that a litigation malpractice claim does not accrue until the plaintiff's damages are certain and not contingent upon the outcome of any other proceeding that might render those damages uncertain, such as in this case, a petition for writ of certiorari to the U.S. Supreme Court. And that's really the fundamental argument that we are making in this case. As one Iowa court put it, the date of injury coincides with the last possible date when the attorney's negligence becomes irreversible.
Mr. Albright, my concerns are how far should we stretch this out on the statute of limitations? And Semenza laid out this rule. Generally, a petition for certiorari to U.S. Supreme Court is like a Hail Mary. I mean, they grant 1 in 1,000 or something in them here. And so if we're going to set a policy on this, I mean, this is, to me, a pretty serious issue. We're extending the time period on the statute of limitations. So tell us why we should do that.
Well, my argument would be, Your Honor, that as long as there is an attempt being made to reverse or undo the damages from the alleged litigation malpractice, those attempts should be allowed to play out, and we should know that we really do have a malpractice claim that has accrued before it is brought. And so I would argue that as long, for example, as a timely petition for rehearing to the Nevada Supreme Court is filed after the initial decision, that should be included within the time period, that if there's a timely petition for reconsideration en banc, that should be included within the time period, and that if there is a petition for writ of certiorari that is timely, that should be included. And I think...
The remitter issued in this case,
yes.
Which I understand if the U.S. Supreme Court had taken jurisdiction and reversed, credited my colleagues in my position as the dissent on the denial of rehearing.
Sure, and that was the basis for that petition for a writ, was the dissent that you had authored.
The remitter has consequence. It makes the opinion of the panel that decided this case final, unless the U.S. Supreme Court did something. I'm a bit troubled, in addition to the point that Justice Gibbons raises about how far do you take this, but I understand other states that have a Semenza rule carry it through the end of the cert process.
That's
if
true.
That occurs, but I couldn't find anybody who said they let the remitter issue and they're still saying that the pendency of the writ petition to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And I don't know that issue has been addressed. It's actually a fairly small subset of cases out
it's
there
a bit
anyway.
Arcane, yeah.
That have even, that both one are from a state that recognizes the...
I found Arizona and
toll timing, the tolling pending appeal, or I like to refer to it more as the claim accrual delay pending appeal rule, and that have also addressed the question of what you do with the petition for writ. And I think, though, that in that small subset of cases, all of the cases go our way.
My I think they do, too, except for none raises
but none of
this
them
remitter.
Have raised this particular issue. And my argument with respect to the remitter is very simple, and that is to go back to my original point, which is to say that the claim accrues when damages become certain. And so the question then is, did the remitter do something to magically render the damages certain?
Well, the judgment became executable at that point,
the judgment
even if it had been stayed.
Okay.
The remitter would transfer jurisdiction back to the district court, and you would be done for, I think.
Certainly, and it may be something that needs to be addressed on a case-by-case basis, because in this case, for instance, I don't think the judgment was executable once the remitter went down, because there was a bankruptcy stay in place by that point. But be that as it may, my point would be that there's nothing magical about a remitter that renders the petition for writ no longer valid. The fact of the matter is that as long as that petition for writ was pending, my client's damages were uncertain and were conditioned upon the outcome of that petition. And the remitter did not change that, because as you know, if a writ had in fact issued from the U.S. Supreme Court, the remitter would simply have been recalled, and this court could then have proceeded in accordance with any instructions received from the U.S. Supreme Court. And we have cited a lot of cases from around the country that does address that particular issue of what is the effect of a remitter once the U.S. Supreme Court grants a petition. And
well,
the
what
answer
if there's
to that
like
question,
a 60B filing, say the judgment becomes final and then 6 months, or even if it's under one of the other subcategories, any reasonable time,
sure.
Such a motion is filed. Now, would the statute still be told? It would have become final, and then it would be told again because...
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it's like this. You know, when the judgment came down, you could say, gee, the damages have now been incurred, and the statute is going to run, except that if within 30 days they file a notice of appeal, then we would say, oh, no, now we have to say the statute of limitations has not begun to run again. And I would say that what I'm talking about is really that appellate process. And as long as the requests for rehearing are timely filed, the petition for rehearing in banc is timely filed, and a petition for writ is timely filed, then those are really the timelines that I'm
well,
talking
what's the
about.
Reason to distinguish a 60B six-month filing?
Because I think at that point you really do start to get into the concerns that Justice Gibbons raised in his initial question about how long are we going to wait to make sure that this has now become final. And again, I would say that if no petition for writ of certiorari had issued in this case, then I would agree that, you know, once the petition, or once the remitter issued, or even earlier, once the decision issued denying the petition for rehearing in Bonk, that at that point, you know, the statute of limitations.
You know, this issue has been raised in the context of a petition for certiorari to the Supreme Court, but it has significant implications under Nevada law. I'd like both sides to address this. Suppose your decision originally had been made by the Court of Appeals. Our review of Court of Appeals decisions is completely discretionary within the confines, at least, of the provisions in Rule 40, but it's still discretionary. So it seems like our approach to this legal question should be considered in that context, and we should be consistent. If, for example, we're going to consider the tolling rule to apply to discretionary appellate review, then it should apply across the board, not only to petitions to the U.S. Supreme Court, but also petitions to us from the Court of Appeals. And so if we don't do that, how would one distinguish?
Well, I would agree that it would need to be consistent, and I would agree that if you were to rule in this case the way I'm asking you to rule, that same rule should apply to a timely filed petition for review by the High Court of the Intermediate Court's ruling. In fact, I think I don't think it's in our briefs before this court, but I think in the paperwork with the lower court in this case, there was a Florida case cited where that was the issue that I believe came up, was internally within the state of Florida, they have a petition for writ process. And I believe the holding in that case was to say, as we would say with the U.S. Supreme Court cases, as long as they timely file that petition, then an appeal is pending. And I guess that goes back to this question of, you know, what is an appeal? And obviously, in certain circumstances, the rules provide that we differentiate between an appeal versus a petition for writ of mandamus in terms of which rules of appellate procedure apply. But I think there's a broader definition that is often used to discuss appeal. And that's the broad definition that's used in Black's Law Dictionary. That's the broad definition that was adopted by the California Supreme Court in the Powers case to say, look, generally speaking, broadly speaking, any resort to a superior court is an appeal, whether that's an appeal of right or whether that's a petition seeking a discretionary review. The question for me comes down again to, once you've timely made that request, that petition to a higher court, whether it's a right or whether it's something that they can reject, as long as that's been timely made and it's pending, it seems to me that the existence of that pending action creates an uncertainty and raises the possibility that the damages are now conditional on the outcome of that pending procedure. And so going back again to the fundamental Semenza rule, damages do not accrue. And you know, the way that Semenza worded it in the context of the Semenza case, which wasn't really even a statute of limitations case, but a case where they were arguing that it had been filed too soon, was to say a legal malpractice action does not accrue until the plaintiff's damages are certain and not contingent upon the outcome of an appeal. And certainly in this case, the damages that BB&T suffered were not certain as long as that petition for writ was pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. Those damages remained contingent upon the outcome of that proceeding. And so my argument would simply be apply that same rule to any proceeding that keeps the damages from being certain. You know, there's a...
You're in your rebuttal time. You realize that?
I'm in my rebuttal time?
Yes.
Then I will stop.
May it please the court, my name is Robert Larson. I'm here on behalf of the respondents, Douglas Gerard and Gerard Cox Larson. And with me is Craig Merriam, also of our firm, on behalf of the respondents. I'd like to jump in and talk about a couple of the questions that were answered today. Because the reason we are here is because of one particular thing, and that's that the appellant did not avail itself of a procedural process to protect itself from the remitter being issued. And that's under Nevada Rule of Appellate Procedure 41B2. If they had requested a stay, then while they were engaging in the process to appeal, or not appeal, but do a petition, writ petition to the United States Supreme Court, the remitter would not have issued. The appeal would not have closed. So, turning to a couple of the questions. Justice Hardesty asked, what about the current situation with the Nevada Appeals Court and the discretionary reviews that go up? We actually have an answer to that question. At the time this case was filed, Rule 41B did not have the appeals court established. That was back in 2010. However, the current version actually addresses that precise issue on the remitter. And the current version says that with any petition for rehearing, it automatically stays the remitter. For any petition for discretionary review from the Nevada Appeals Court to this court, it stays the remitter. But, and this is critical, it's different for the United States Supreme Court.
Let me ask you this, though. I mean, the rationale on Semenza, and I don't know if Semenza were before us as an original matter, I'd decide it the same way, but it's our precedent. And I think part of the rationale for that is that a lawyer-client relationship exists in the matter under litigation, and where the lawyer alleged to commit the malpractice is representing the client, it is very awkward and unreasonable to expect the client to be suing that lawyer for malpractice while the appeal runs its course. And if we're going to get into a tricky area like remitter, the lawyer who's representing the client says, yeah, I've petitioned the United States Supreme Court to take your case. The decision denying en banc rehearing was 5-2. They're raising federal grounds. We believe we have it's worth the money involved to take this case to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the client isn't told this tricky little piece about the remitter. Is that really consistent with the rationale of Semenza, that you don't want to have the law be disrupting the attorney-client relationship until all the dust is settled and the battlefield has the living and the dead on it from the original case one standpoint? Do you follow my question?
I believe so. And
it's a very technical, remitter is very technical.
Absolutely. But it also is very significant. It's not a ministerial act. It has a consequence.
It shifts jurisdiction and it's a bright line. I get it.
Absolutely. And so starting with that point is, let me first say, is that's not the situation here because the respondents were not the appellate counsel. So we don't have that situation here in this case.
But I understand
that. The hypothetical is that in that instance, Rule 41B2 offers that protection. It keeps the consequence from happening. Now, if the lawyer then does not file that claim, perhaps that is a new claim for malpractice that would continue on. That's a new incident of malpractice. So it is a difficult question, undoubtedly.
Well, I have another policy question associated with that. If we were to adopt the approach advocated by Mr. Albright, what about the flip side of this issue? Does this allow the attorney to say, well, your failure to seek a U.S. Supreme Court review provides a basis for me to argue that the client failed to mitigate damages?
I don't think so. And the reason for that is in the Hewitt, I believe it's the Hewitt decision, the court said, frivolous appeal, you don't have to pursue it, and you still have your claim. Now, there may be some motion practice that's required at the district court level to determine whether it was frivolous or not. But we know that the United States Supreme Court accepts an extremely small fraction of these writ petitions. And they're typically geared on certain types of issues. They have a rule that spells out the types of issues that they accept. So if it's an evidence-based question, that to me would be a frivolous request. But that would ultimately have to be something that is decided at the district court on whether that would handle it. But this court has already weighed in and said you don't have that obligation to pursue a frivolous appeal. So one thing that if we look at Semenza, and that is the case that both parties cite to, it is the ground zero for the tolling rule for litigation malpractice claims. And yes, there is language talking about when damages are certain. But if we also go further and look at what those actually said, where it leads to, it also says until affirmed on appeal. And language matters. Appeal. In the paragraph on page 668 of the decision that sets forth the principle, the word appeal is used three times in that same context. Nowhere else is appellate jurisdiction used, writ, anything that would expand beyond the narrow construct of appeal. The following paragraph in that decision is where the court actually applies it to the facts. At least five times they talk about resolution on appeal.
So your argument would be that the appeal is resolved when the remitter is issued. That's
correct.
The end of the story right there.
Correct. And I do want to let the court know is that our trial judge made what we believe to be a technical error in that she directed the time from the appeal decision, not the remitter. The case law from this court, and there's a lot of it, says the remitter ends the appeal. So to us, we think that is actually the appropriate time to run from. Now, the difference...
And we use that in other contexts. Habeas corpus on the criminal side, remitted or issue has a legal significance, and it is a date certain.
Yes. And so, with following up on that point is, in this case, it doesn't matter. The difference between those two dates doesn't matter. It could in other cases, but in this case, it does not. Following what Justice Pickering just mentioned is, if you go to the Semenza language and the progeny, all the cases behind that, all reference appeal or cite directly back to the Semenza standard. So if you look at that standard and apply it here or in other cases, what you have is you have a bright line test. This is when the claim accrues. And if a party elects to pursue a writ with the United States Supreme Court, they have a mechanism to keep that appeal open during that entire time. It's a straightforward mechanism under 41b2. And if you apply the Semenza standard in conjunction with that right that a litigant would have, what you have is a bright line test that can be applied across the board. And it accomplishes the fundamental policy considerations for both the statute of limitations and the claim accrual. So what you really have is a functional test that is not confusing. It's easily applied to nearly every case, maybe a few exceptions here and there, but nearly every case. You don't have to deal with it on a case-by-case basis. Perhaps the bankruptcy filing might result in not being able to pursue something down the line, but it doesn't stop when the claim would actually accrue. So that is one of if we continue the Semenza standard, that's the roadmap to creating certainty. If we open the door to a discretionary review after the remitter is issued, we face a lot of consequences, remitter potentially being recalled. What does that mean? As for claim accrual. And then, as Justice Pickering raised in the questions towards the appellant, is the Rule 60B problem. Where do you draw the line? Rule 60B is... Justice Pickering correctly referenced has two parts to it. One is the six-month period for a variety of different issues, and that's independent of the appeal. That can be done whether the appeal is proceeding or not. But more significantly is the other provisions, fraud on the court-type provision, that could be indefinite. File an independent action a year, 2 years down the line. Does that make the damages uncertain? Under the theory proposed by the appellants, it would have to. And so where do you draw the line? If you go back to the Semenza standard, it is clear. It sets a bright line test that accomplishes the same policy considerations.
Could I ask you to address the other part of your argument? As I understand your briefs, you're saying even if they convince us that the statute of limitations on the remitter, that we should wait till the Supreme Court decided the whole thing, that you have a fallback, which is this claim is a non-starter anyway as a matter of law.
Correct. And let me start with the legal proposition, which is this court has said several times that it has the authority and the right to issue a decision on a different ground than what the district court made its original decision on, provided that there is a legitimate ground in the record to make that decision. And what we have here is a case where the trial judge made some determinations about the ownership slash assignment of certain deeds of trust, of a deed of trust. And she reached that decision in her findings, fact, conclusions of law, which led to the judgment. And there are several findings on that point. And what the appellants want to say is stop there. Everything else is dicta after that, you can't use it. But that ignores the actual procedural posture of that case, which was it was two separate actions consolidated. There was a counterclaim. Those are independent claims. And if you look at, if you break it all out and look at the findings of fact and conclusions of law that the trial court issued, is what you have is on the appellant's claim against an entity known as RS Lenders, it was the one with the competing deed of trust. She said on the appellant's affirmative claim, they don't have the right to pursue it based on an evidentiary failure to support their document, the contract, so they couldn't do it. But that's not what she did with the claim from RS Lenders back to the appellants. What she did there is she heard evidence and made decisions, factual determinations about what documents were signed when they were presented. And that's the ground she used to give RS Lenders a judgment in their favor on their counterclaim. It did not arise out of the appellant's claim. It arose out of their own counterclaim. And one of the conclusions of law specifically references RS Lenders' first cause of action. So that tells us that when the trial judge was looking at it, she was evaluating two different claims. And so because of that, they cannot show causation. That decision is final. It's never been
referred. Was this underlying case out of the SFR decision? Is that what the priority in deeds of trust is, or is it something else?
No, this is something else. This goes well before that, the SFR decision, back in 2010. And it related to a deed of trust, and the argument from the appellant was that because their deed of trust, there were documents that weren't signed during the recording process, they ended up falling to second place. And the RS Lenders ended up moving from second to first place. And the argument by the appellant at the trial level was for equitable subrogation, that they should be able to, because of the context of the transaction and communication, they should be able to jump ahead. Okay. And what the trial judge in the underlying case said, no, you don't have evidence that they signed this document, they received this subordination document, and ultimately that's what she found. And that is a separate and independent ground from the argument that appellants have been making, saying you have to stop here because it was a quasi-standing issue. And in this instance, that's a binding decision. That was never reversed on appeal. And so with that in place, there is no way, as a matter of law, they can show causation. One last point, as I notice my time is just running very short, is if we talk about this appellate process that is referenced by the appellants quite a bit, they want to broaden Semenza, appellate process, any judicial proceeding. As I mentioned before, that's very broad. And one of the things that they fall back to cite to is Black's Law Dictionary. And they say, well, look, the dictionary definition of appeal includes a discretionary review. That is not the definition of appeal in Black's Law Dictionary as of 2009. That section was removed. We cited a case out of the Ninth Circuit which quotes the provision and tells us and explains there's a difference between petition and appeal. And it quotes the appeal section. And it was not, that the section that they quote to was not there in 2009. This case was a 2010 case. The applicable definition from that supporting authority supports our position. There's no other questions? Thank you.
You have 1 minute and 7 seconds.
Let me address just really quickly the follow-up argument. Not with respect to the statute of limitations, but the merits of the case. I think, first of all, that it should be noted there was only one party that put on any evidence at trial below, and that was my client. And at the end of that evidence, a 52C motion was brought and was granted. So there was never another separate putting on of evidence as to the counterclaim. I think if you look at the conclusions of law and findings of fact that Judge Gonzalez issued, what you will find is that, yes, she reached some decisions on a contractual claim that we had, that there was some sort of oral agreement to subrogate to us. What she didn't reach was the equitable subrogation argument, the equitable replacement argument, which was our strongest argument below. It wasn't an SFR issue. It's equitable replacement, that when you come in and you pay off an earlier loan, you get that priority. The only thing the judge really said about that was that since BB&T had not established that it owned this claim, it could not prove that equitable replacement argument. And just to give you an idea, if I can
30 seconds
finish, you know, there is a case out there, Branch Banking and Trust v. DMSI, 871 F3rd 751, Ninth Circuit 2017, that is the what might have been case, where Branch Banking in Nevada pursued a bunch of the loans that it had gotten from Colonial. It was successful in pursuing them, and they tried to argue to the Ninth Circuit, look at Judge Gonzalez's decision, they don't own these loans. And the Ninth Circuit said, oh, no, that was not on the merits. That has no res judicata effect.
What's the cite to that again?
That is,
you said
871 F3rd 751. And I think if you look at that, and then if you would look at the pages that we cited in our respondents answering brief from the record, you would see this is a very complicated issue on which I think a motion for summary judgment would be much more appropriate than a motion to dismiss. I think our First Amendment complaint states a claim.
Thank you very much. This matter will stand submitted. And